Last year, on the 50th anniversary, we at Radio Prague covered many aspects of the 1968 invasion of Czechoslovakia. But what was life like after the Soviet occupation began? The normalization period is the specialization of Czech-born historian Paulina Bren, and she is Ian Willoughby's guest in this edition of One on One.
In her book, The Greengrocer and His TV, The Culture of Communism After the 1968 Prague Spring, historian Paulina Bren offers fresh perspectives on various aspects of Czechoslovakia's normalization period. These include how the communists used TV serials to get their message across at a time when the nation, forced to accept the reimposition of relatively hardline rule, largely turned inward. She makes particular reference to TV writer Yaroslav Dietl, creator of some of the most popular shows of that era. But when we met in New York, Bren, who was born Pavlina Brzeňová in Brno, first told me how her own family had escaped Czechoslovakia when she was an infant, at the very time normalization was beginning to take hold.
My parents left with me and my sister in September of 1969, just a few weeks before the borders closed. And of course they needed an exit visa at that time. They needed an invitation letter, and my mother wrote to friends of hers, Zdeňa Zabreska, I believe, who's a poet, and she with her husband, they were in Paris, and they received the letter literally as they were closing the door on the apartment and heading to the train station to return to Prague. So Zdeňa quickly penned a letter, pretending she was some French person living in Paris. My mother received it. It was just for my father and her. So she quickly added, et les enfants, which was my sister and me. So that's how the exit visa happened. And then this was already a year after the invasion. So there was really, at that point, Czechoslovakia was very much cut off from the West. But the Hotel International in Brno still was getting Western newspapers. So my father went there, found the London Times, went through it, saw an ad for a computer programmer, which was quite a specialty then, wrote a letter to them, never heard back from them, but then decided we should just go there. So my mother was sick and stayed with us. He headed to London, showed up at this firm. They didn't know what he was doing there. He didn't have an interview, but they interviewed him and they gave him a job on the spot. And then my mother, my sister and I followed soon after. 3 weeks later, the borders closed. So it was two kids, two suitcases and $100 because they had to leave everything behind and pretend they were going on vacation.
Jumping forward quite a way, in your book, The Greengrocer on His Television, The Culture of Communism After the 1968 Prague Spring, you talk about being in Prague in the late 1980s and getting under the space where the Stalin statue had stood. How did you get in there? What did you find there?
Oh my, I was there in 1987, and I just graduated from Wesleyan University here in the US. We emigrated one more time, and I became obsessed with coming to Prague, and I couldn't find a way to do it, and finally decided to just come on a tourist visa. While I was waiting for the tourist visa, I was in London, and to stay in cheap accommodations, I stayed at the Catholic Czech Center Velehrad, where I had always gone every Saturday to learn how to say R. And I met an artist, Petr, who had just escaped from Prague. So it was sort of bizarre. I was now heading to Prague, and he sort of introduced me to all of his artist friends. So I had a really interesting view of Prague. I was there for a month. And through one of these artist friends, who was a climber, a caver, I suppose they're called, he and another friend, they decided it would be really amusing to take me down under Stalin. Of course, it was completely illegal, but they had done it several times. So middle of the night, flashlights and so forth, and they knew how to get in there. It was quite scary. There was especially this moment where there was just a mound of thousands and thousands of shoes. And of course, that is reminiscent for anybody of the Holocaust. So I don't know what they were doing there, but that image has always stuck with me.
The central theme of your book is the normalization period in Czechoslovakia. I've always thought normalization was a very strange word. Who coined the word, or when did it enter usage?
It is a strange word. The first official enunciation of the term happened when Dubček and his cabinet were returned from house arrest in Moscow a week after the invasion. He went on the radio in Czechoslovakia and explained that they'd come to an agreement about the rapid normalization of the situation. And it became an official word for it. And Husák, after 1989, claimed, oh, he did not conceive of the idea of normalization. Everybody did, because what else could one do with thousands and thousands of Soviet troops now occupying Czechoslovakia? What I love, I think part of sort of the Czech penchant for the absurd made it also very appropriate, because what else to call the abnormality of normalization than normalizacja?
In your book, there's one fact that I found completely eye-popping. I never heard this before, and that is about the screenings of Communist Party members after the beginning, I guess, of normalization, when something like 250,000 committee members screened 1.5 million members of the Communist Party. What was the purpose of that screening?
Yes, it's strange, actually, that it's not really, one doesn't read about that very much, but I think it was absolutely pivotal to normalization. Originally, the Soviets hoped to just simply put in a new regime straight after the invasion, but they saw that was impossible. And they let Dubček hang on till April of 1969, Husák took over, and then the purges started in the summer. And first they were very much aimed at the really public celebrity figures of the Prague Spring. But then they went into, these purges really were mandated every single workplace. And even if nobody was purged, everybody received a form which they had to answer. And they had to say if they agreed or disagreed with the invasion, among other things. And in a sense, it was a pledge of allegiance. So it turned everybody into signatories to normalization. I think that was a really important part of trying to understand sort of the context of collaboration, if one might call it, or perhaps something milder, after 1968.
For those who don't get the reference, who is the greengrocer of your title?
Oh, the greengrocer is, of course, Václav Havel's greengrocer. And I sort of posit his idea of the everyday man in his wonderful essay about the greengrocer with sort of the everyday man that the television writer Yaroslav Dietl created in his television serials. And in a way, unfortunately, Yaroslav Dietl's everyday man was a little closer to the truth than sort of the wished-for greengrocer. I mean, Havel describes the greengrocer in terms of this very wide, odd spectrum of collaboration that normalization sort of demanded, but he hopes for the greengrocer to sort of take a stand that I think was very more complex than sometimes Havel realized.
Were the only two choices to essentially accept normalization and accept warm party rule or to become a dissident?
No, I don't think so, and I think that was part of the problem. That was why ultimately Charter 77 and Havel and other dissidents had such a resonance here in the West. But my book also deals with the question of why did they have so little resonance within Czechoslovakia among ordinary citizens. Part of that problem, I think, is precisely that it was set up in a very sort of binary opposition, whereas the 70s and 80s normalization, or late communism as I refer to it, was very much about the gray areas. And indeed, in the mid-1980s, there was a big raucous within Charter 77 itself, where all these younger signatories who were not Prague-based were writing to the Prague headquarters and saying, we don't have a relationship to you. We can't relate to you. You don't relate to us. You don't actually care about how we think. And we have sort of united forces, not with other charter signatories, but actually with younger people who have different interests, different passions, different sort of ideas that they're pursuing. And it's these people that now are speaking to what an opposition will be.
There's also, I think, a sense that the kind of carrot of normalization was consumerism, that people received more products. But how does that square with the general image of communism as being a period of scarcity, of queues and lack?
I have to say I don't like that whole carrot metaphor that's always used. I think in terms of becoming a consumer, if you have even less to consume, I think that in fact forms you as a consumer even more, because whether you're on the hunt for something as vital as toilet paper or something as desirable as 1980s VCRs and calculators, it changes your everyday practices, it changes your outlook and so forth. And I think in many ways, because of this emphasis on consumerism or consumption, because there wasn't that much, I mean, Czechoslovakia was still better off than other East Bloc countries, but nevertheless, because of that, everything was framed in terms of consumption. So when the Velvet Revolution happened, the idea of joining the West, of becoming European again, of entering that capitalist realm, was framed in terms of consumption, and that led to a lot of disappointments.
You also speak in your book about the role played by television in normalization. In a nutshell, what was that role?
In 1968, during the Prague Spring, radio still had, I would say, the most prominent role. But this was the moment when television began to shine. So when the invasion happened and the purge began, of course, the key targets were the media. Even as they were purging these media centers, they were also trying to figure out how they could use them. They realized it was necessary. And they sort of stumbled upon this realization that everybody, and they, of course, were doing surveys left and right. They're reading letters from citizens. But they realized that everybody, statistically, everybody was switching off the news. So they ended up sort of inserting the information they want to get across into the entertainment production instead. And television serials were particularly potent for this, in large part because Yaroslav Dietl, this famous Czech television writer, who in fact was very much for the Prague Spring, and they had to sort of bring him back, he had to purge himself a little bit, and then they brought him back. But Yaroslav Dietl had been fascinated already back in the 50s and the 60s with the genre of the television serial, and he had sort of convinced Czechoslovak television to let him write these, and they were very popular, so this was a perfect vehicle. He was a skilled writer, and he made the decision to write these television serials, and the regime was able to really use them as a way to have discussions in a seemingly non-political way, to have discussions about key issues, to show that they were solving problems. We're solving problems with housing, with single mothers, with a broken down healthcare system. All of these could sort of be sorted through seeing the images of these good, kind, constructive communists who understood the errors of ways and were able to change things and get Czechoslovakia back on the right path.
One thing also you refer to in your book is the returnees, people who left after 68 and then came back and perhaps then appeared on TV explaining where they'd gone wrong.
Right, exactly. Again, the numbers weren't huge, but certainly the call to emigres, to people like my parents who had fled, there were cycles of that, and they were promised pardons, and people did return, because it's very hard. I mean, it's very hard to show up in a foreign country without the language, without the contacts, friends, family, money, cultural knowledge. So understandably, it could be enticing to return with a pardon. And of course, in return for that, they were often met right on the tarmac. They were interviewed in order to say, of course, what was wrong with their experience in the West. And that sort of narrative was able to be woven into the narrative of the socialist good life, which, going back to the consumerist question, the recognition that, well, yes, we can't offer all the consumer goods that the West has, but we can offer other things, the socialist good life. That means, you know, we're not going to monitor you that much that you work that hard at work. We won't really check in on the 9 to 5. You'll have lots of time for hobbies, friends, social life, and so forth. That is what we can offer.
Is it possible to speak generally about how normalization is perceived today by Czechs?
I'm not sure I could actually speak to that. But I have to say, it's shocking. I'm sure you've read sort of those newspaper articles as well about the interviews on the streets and asking people who was Husák, who was Dubček, what happened in 1968. And it's just shocking. Nobody knows. So to talk about sort of how the Czechs now interpret or think about normalization, I think that really the question is, how do many Czechs even interpret the past? Are they cognizant of the fact that there was a very long period of communism which had very different variations, 1950s versus 1960s versus 70s and 80s of normalization? That's sort of the question of forgetting.
Also, I guess, even though normalization was more recent, it was also less dramatic than many of the moments in the communist era.
Absolutely. I mean, there's sort of, you know, the phrase of banality of evil. I would say normalization, it's so incredibly banal in many ways. But at the same time, that's why it's so instructive. I think when we look at periods of extreme authoritarianism, let's just to stay with communism, to look at Stalinism, then it's easier to sort of take a stand, or at least to imagine oneself as not being a Stalinist, right? Normalization, I think, is far more instructive. It's about a more benign form of authoritarianism, of political ideologies, and the way that people can and do quite easily coexist with those kind of regimes. I think that's the question. So in a sense, I think it's the memory of that which is important.
And I guess from everything you're saying, you don't feel that we're in a position to, in any sense, judge people for, in quotation marks, collaborating with the system in that period?
Absolutely. There was a spectrum, a very large spectrum of collaboration during normalization. And in order to sort of just exist and function, you had to be somewhere on that spectrum. Also, if you were in Prague, it was much easier to protest. If you were in Prague and you were relatively famous, your voice could be heard in the West, it was much easier to protest than, let's say, a school teacher in Zlín. And I think that's important to keep in mind as well.